Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
We are bound to kick off Open House tonight with the huge shock news of this past week, the out-of-the-blue announcement by Pope Benedict XVI that he's resigning the papacy. It's the first time since 1415 that a pope has done such a thing. This is the leader of the 1.2 billion Catholics in the world, one-sixth of the world's population. If you, as a Roman Catholic member of our Open House community, would like to offer your reflections, what this pope has meant to you over these last 7 years, I'd love you to join us on 1300 40 2020. You may have been one of the many, many thousands to have attended those memorable World Youth Day celebrations with Benedict XVI in 2008 in Sydney. Give us a ring with your reflections on that and also what followed in your life. We'd love you to join us on Open House 1300 40 2020. One man who saw the Pope in Rome just a couple of days before this shock announcement is the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Brisbane, Mark Coleridge, who joins us now for his response and his view of what all this means. Archbishop Mark Coleridge, welcome to Open House.
Thank you very much, Lee. Good to be with you.
So, when you saw the Pope just before his resignation, how did he seem to you?
Well, I walked out of the audience that we had, and I said to my colleague next to me, I think he looks better this time than last time. Huh. Mind you, he might have looked better because he'd finally decided to resign. But
yes.
No, I amazingly in Rome, I was there for meetings through a week, and Rome floats on rumour and whispers and gossip and all that sort of thing. Well, there wasn't a hint of that. So here was I, having greeted the Pope on the Thursday morning. I jumped on the plane Sunday night, and I was flying, you know, 30,000 feet in the air when the news broke. So it wasn't until I was at Brisbane Airport at the carousel waiting for my bag, I got a text from my brother in Melbourne saying, what's this about the Pope resigning? Well, I nearly fell onto the carousel.
Yes.
But no, it was certainly stunning news. And yet, since then, I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing. Looking back, you can see a certain pattern of decisions and actions by Pope Benedict that seem now to have looked towards a resignation.
What were they?
Well, see, small things, like he made a detour on one of his trips in Italy to go and pray at the tomb of Pope Celestine V,
yes,
who was one of the last popes to resign. And that struck many people at the time as unusual. I mean, in some ways you'd say, why not? But and even making his private secretary an archbishop. There seemed to be certain things he did and even said that might now look like clearing the desk a bit.
Of the 265 popes throughout the history of the Roman Catholic Church,
mm-hmm,
you say he's among one of the finest theological minds of all of them.
Oh, I think that's true. See, many of the popes, they've been remarkable men, but you wouldn't accuse them of being theological giants.
Yes.
But I think he is certainly one of the finest theological minds that's ever occupied the chair of Peter. I mean, you've got some towering figures in the distant past like St. Gregory the Great and St. Leo the Great, but they were theologians of a different kind. They were theologians, as it were, on the run. He is more, in the contemporary Western sense, a classical theological intelligence, trained in the contemporary world, in other words, the post-Reformation, post-Renaissance, post-Enlightenment world. So he's a theological mind of a different kind than were, say, Pope Gregory the Great or Pope Leo the Great. But I think he's unquestionably up there among the finest theological minds. And that's one of the great gifts he brought to the task of Pope. You go down in history probably as one of the more remarkable teaching popes.
Is that part of the reason why he's been able to break 600 years of tradition and resign the papacy?
I think that's true. I think his theological strength has probably given him the equipment to deal with some of the many questions he's had to deal with in coming to the decision. I think that's certainly true. But beyond a quality of theological intelligence, however important that is, I think there's also a quality of personal courage in this, because
yes,
he's not a... In some ways, he's not a bold man by temperament, as John Paul II was. He's a careful man who thinks things through, and I don't think he would have found this decision easy. But paradoxically, I think it was courageous of John Paul II to stay on. It's no less courageous of Benedict XVI, I think, to step down, because he knows he's created an historical precedent that is quite remarkable.
It's an interesting comparison. How much do you think this move had to do with him being so close to Pope John Paul II, seeing the long demise in his health, the vacuum in many ways that was created around him. Benedict was there alongside him through all that time.
No question, and I think that was an absolutely vital factor. Benedict XVI, as Cardinal Ratzinger, saw Pope John Paul's very public decline, and he also saw very clearly that the Church has no provision whatsoever for a situation where a pope becomes so frail or incapacitated that he can't exercise the office. And if you have a pope in the Catholic Church who can't exercise the office, we have a problem. So I think he saw very clearly that particular weakness, even in church law, and he didn't want a situation where he became so frail and so incapacitated that he wasn't able to exercise the role. But that relationship between Benedict XVI and John Paul II is a crucial one for understanding both men. They couldn't have been more different in temperament and background. I mean, a Pole and a German, if you think of it historically, it's been one of the great antagonisms. Temperamentally, John Paul II was a huge extrovert. Benedict XVI is profoundly introvert. And I could go on and on. They were chalk and cheese, sun and moon. It was a kind of a mysterious symbiosis. John Paul II met every Friday with the then Cardinal Ratzinger. And I think those Friday conversations between the two men shaped the great themes of Pope John Paul's pontificate. So that the Cardinal Ratzinger was a crucial element in the prodigy of John Paul II's pontificate. Equally, Benedict XVI continued trajectories of John Paul II in a very different mode and with a different set of focuses, but nonetheless, the voice and, as it were, the presence of John Paul II, I think, was unmistakable through the 8 years of Benedict XVI. So, in one sense, you can trace a single trajectory from 1978, when John Paul II was elected, astonishingly, down to 2013. With different modulations, there's a single trajectory. And keep in mind that the new pope will be the first pope, in recent times at least, who didn't know the Second World War. Mm. And psychologically, that is a threshold.
Can I ask you this, as one who's related to him, met him up close and personal, how did you find him? What was that relationship, that experience like?
Benedict XVI was not an easy man to know, and was a man who I think was slow to place his trust in others, and tended to surround himself with a close circle of those whom he had known and worked with and trusted. So he wasn't a man of a large circle in the way John Paul II was. He was also physically much harder to contact. John Paul II had people in for Mass every morning, met them after Mass. He had lunch with people every day. I mean, the papal apartment was full of people. Now, with Benedict XVI, it was exactly the opposite. He didn't have people in the morning. He didn't have lunch with others. Mind you, a crucial factor in this is that John Paul II was only 58 when he was elected.
Yes.
Benedict XVI was 78.
Yes.
Now, we're all a bit different 20 years down the track.
Yes.
But it wasn't just a question of age. It was and is a question of temperament. And yet, when you meet Benedict XVI, there's a sense of great personal engagement and warmth. He's not a man for small talk at all. John Paul II was better at that when he was fit. But the way he looks at you, there is a genuine sense of personal engagement. John Paul II, at times, they said, was a bit like a lion who never looks at his prey. He'd be shaking your hand and looking at the person next to you. So in some ways, you could say John Paul II was better with the big crowd. Benedict XVI was never a man of the crowds. John Paul II loved all of that. But Benedict XVI, one-to-one, was in some ways a more engaging character than John Paul II.
Archbishop, can I ask you about the question of papal infallibility?
Yeah.
How does that sit with the Pope's decision to resign?
Well, it doesn't affect it whatsoever, because what we call papal infallibility touches only matters, the most solemn matters of church teaching. And this is a personal and administrative decision with all kinds of ramifications in church life. But it's not of the order of issue that papal infallibility deals with. Papal infallibility is simply one way in which the Catholic Church says that Christ's promise that he would send the Spirit of Truth to the Church, in other words, preserve the Church at its core from error, at times that charism of truthfulness is exercised by the Bishop of Rome in the name of the entire College of Bishops and the entire college of the entire church around the world, so that this issue doesn't at all shade into the area touched by papal infallibility, which only touches upon the most fundamental matters of what Christians believe and teach.
So after he relinquishes the papacy come March, he loses that infallibility?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It never attaches to the person of the Pope. It attaches to the office. In other words, what we call the Petrine office, which means the Pope is the successor of Peter. But the fundamental thing to grasp with infallibility is that promise of Christ to send the Spirit of Truth into the Church. Now, either Christ has honoured that promise or he hasn't. Now, the Church, and indeed popes, have made mistakes through history, but in areas that don't, as I say, touch upon papal infallibility. What we say is that at its core, the truth is intact. In other words, the very essentials of what Christ has handed on to us remain intact, and that is because of the promise that he himself has made and has honoured. So that the Pope at times, the College of Bishops at times, all in together can work to ensure that that truthfulness remains intact.
This papacy certainly didn't ignore Australia, did it?
No, it didn't. And it has been said that Pope Benedict had a bit of a soft spot for Australia. I think in some ways that's true. He's known Cardinal Pell for a very long time, long before he was Pope. They worked together and has a high regard for the Archbishop of Sydney. So that's one factor. Also, the rector of the seminary here in Brisbane, Monsignor Anthony Randazzo, worked with the Pope in Rome, and there was a strong bond there. But I think also that the Pope was bowled over by the experience of World Youth Day in Sydney. He wasn't sure if he could make it. I remember meeting him before World Youth Day and saying, "We're looking forward. We very much hope you can be with us in Sydney for World Youth Day." And he looked at me with a little smile and said, "Oh, perhaps." But once he's never been a natural traveller, and I think he was a bit apprehensive about the long journey. But once he got here, I think he was just dazzled by the experience. I saw him not long after World Youth Day in Rome, and I said to him, "It was wonderful to have you with us." And he said, "Oh, it was a wonderful experience." And the other thing that I think really touched him was St. Mary MacKillop being Australia's first saint. I think for him it wasn't just another cab off the rank. I think that she being the first, and given the immense popular reaction that drew in Australia, I think that struck him and gave him a deeper sense of and perhaps affection for Australia.
When you stand back and view Benedict's papacy, how do you believe history will judge it?
Well, history doesn't judge popes in the short term. No. It judges them in the long term, and it tends to move beyond ideology or axe grinding. Now, I think he will be remembered as one of the strongest and best teaching popes, and that won't be just his teaching as pope, which as a body has been remarkable enough, but his whole corpus through a lifetime. If you look at the Opera Omnia, the complete works of Joseph Ratzinger, it's an extraordinary body of work. And a great gift to the Church, and I think the world, in fact. Because what Ratzinger has always had an extraordinary ability to say deep and complex things in a simple and accessible way without reducing them. It's a great gift he's got. And that, as I say, I think is a gift. He can articulate timeless truths in with words and images that are somehow fresh and in no way reductive. So I think he'll be remembered as a great teaching pope. I think he won't be remembered as one who was a man naturally given to governing. To govern the universal church is almost to govern the ungovernable.
Yes.
But so I think that wasn't his strength, and I suspect he knew it. He didn't have much experience of governing. So in those, a bit like the Archbishop of Canterbury, I have to say, Rowan Williams, who, again, a brilliant man, but didn't seem to be attuned always to the wide, complex political reality that he was addressing. And that's why both the Archbishop of Canterbury and Pope Benedict, I think, at times were a bit gaffe-prone. They didn't seem to have 20/20 vision that the politician has.
So now, when the former Pope relinquishes the papacy, he retires to a former nunnery in the Vatican, order of nuns who used to grow the Pope's vegetables. Is there an expectation that he will continue to be a significant thinker and writer in Catholic theology?
I don't think. He may write, and I'd be very surprised if he didn't, because that's been his lifetime. But I think he will, this man particularly, will retire to a genuine seclusion and a life of utter discretion that won't in any way impinge upon the freedom of his successor. I think he in particular is capable of that. Other men might find it more difficult, but I don't think there's the slightest risk that he'll be breathing down the neck of his successor. And when he finishes, I've just read, he's going to move from the Vatican up to the summer villa at Castel Gandolfo in the immediate aftermath of his retirement. And what they will do is they'll complete the works for his apartment at the convent in the gardens of the Vatican, which, see, people have questioned that decision, but, I mean, in terms of security and seclusion, you couldn't get a better place.
Yes.
I mean, I know the place well because I used to go for walks in the Vatican Gardens, and it's a lovely setting. The security is second to none, and will provide the Pope with the privacy and seclusion he obviously seeks.
Archbishop Mark Coleridge, very grateful for you joining us on Open House. Thank you so much indeed for your time.
Thank you, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.